Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. You know, I've said it before, but the joy of doing this podcast is getting to talk to some amazing people and sharing them with you. And today is no different. Professor Kenneth Stahl serves as Associate Professor of Clinical Surgery as a clinical educator of the voluntary staff at the DeWitt Family Department of Surgery Division of Trauma, Critical Care and Burns at the University of Miami Health System and the Miller School of Medicine in Florida in the good old US of A. Ken and I met a number of years ago when I was visiting his institution, and we discovered that we shared a love of flying as well as medicine. Ken obtained his education at Amherst College in Massachusetts for his undergraduate degree, and then he attended New York's University School of Medicine for their MD-PhD program, graduating with honors. After residency, he completed fellowships at Jackson Memorial Medical Center in Miami and the Cleveland Clinic, very, very impressive places. And then he worked at the University of South Dakota, San Diego in California, and then back at the Cleveland Clinic. He's been a military surgeon and works with the Army Trauma Training Center, or AATC. One thing I learned at my time in America is they do love their abbreviations. And Ken is devoted to excellence in clinical practice. And I can tell you he's the total package, a well-educated and curious surgeon dedicated to patient care, research and education, and has been an active author, speaker, and received countless awards. And as I hinted earlier, when not working, Ken is an accomplished and experienced pilot with what is called airline transport pilot certifications, a multi-engine and instrument ratings. He's a captain in the United States Air Force Auxiliary, serves with me on the board of medical advisors of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, or AOPA, and is heavily involved with the Angel Flight missions. Bless him for that. So it's my great pleasure to welcome fellow pilot and surgeon, Professor Kenneth Stahl, to the podcast. And as we pilots say, chocks away.
Well, thank you. That was probably the most generous introduction I've ever received. I appreciate it and just want to respond that it's been my pleasure with all the involvement you and I have shared. I think it's been tremendously rewarding. So I appreciate all of that too.
Well, I think the pilot community is very, very lucky to have you involved. And I feel very privileged to have met you and to know you. And I'm really looking forward to this chat. So Ken, let's start inevitably with flying. And I must first note that you're no ordinary aviator. You've been recognized by the Flight Standards District Office, or FISDO, for contributions to aviation safety, and honored as the Dr. Franklin G. Norris Pilot of the Year, which is presented for excellence and dedication to the medical missions of mercy. So tell the audience, what got you into flying, and what do you think is the symbiosis for pilots and doctors? Because there's quite a lot of us who do both.
Yes, there certainly is. That's the key to my dual existence in the world, which has been being a cardiac surgeon and a trauma surgeon, as well as a pilot, and being triple board certified in surgery and risen through the ranks of airline pilot training from just a student pilot all through the general aviation, commercial aviation, and finally ATP levels. The training, as you have alluded to, is very similar. The skills are different. The vocabulary is obviously different. But as I tell my residents and students and doctors when I talk to them about aviation safety principles, and pilots when I speak with them about medical safety principles, the major similarity is our mind. We think about information, we process information, we solve problems, and frankly, the dark side of all that is we make mistakes in a very similar manner because our minds are the same mind, just doing different skills and using different words. So there's a huge similarity in the data processing and the problem solving and the data storage, the knowledge storage in our brains necessary to do both and to do both well. And I think that's probably the biggest similarity that I've found. I've been fascinated with aviation and wanted to be a pilot since I was a kid. And when I earned some money in my early years of finishing my residency and becoming a doctor, I started taking flying lessons and have bought into, now I'm on my third airplane. And I just love the sense of freedom and the thrill of flying airplanes. And it's something I don't think I'll ever be tired of.
I tell people, well, first of all, the first comment you made about the symbiosis between the two professions, there's a wonderful book by Atul Gawande, Complications. And I always, damn it, he wrote the book I always wanted to write. But I'm pleased he wrote it first because he did a much better job than I would have done. But you're so right about the processing of information and having checklists and those sort of things are now finding their way into medicine. But flying, for those of you out there who haven't tried it, it's a wonderful condensation of physical skills, mental skills, and also there's the poetic to it, right? You know, taking off on a mist-shrouded morning, seeing mist in the valleys, or flying at night and seeing the heavens above you, it's awe-inspiring, right?
It truly is. I mean, it without being an instrument pilot sitting in the front seat looking out the front window, that sense of just taking off on a misty, cloudy day and all of a sudden bursting through the top of the clouds into the sunshine is an awe-inspiring and an image and a feeling I don't think I would ever get enough of. And as you said, I mean, the challenges and the skills, having flown everything from little two-seater trainers to, jet-powered airplanes. I mean, there's no real fundamental difference except, like I said, in the vocabulary. You can hurt yourself or hurt someone else just as quickly in a big airplane as a small airplane. So,
an operating theater for that matter. So let's drill down into that a little bit, because in one of your very excellent AOPA articles, and folks, they are available online, you talk about the right stuff, a phrase that's been used in reference to the early astronauts, right? And you quoted physicist Niels Bohr, who said, an expert is a man who has made all the mistakes that can be made in a narrow field. How does one become an expert as a doctor or an aviator? How does one balance humility and introspection with professional pride and confidence while avoiding hubris?
Well, that's an excellent question that hopefully I can do justice to with something of an answer. You know, I've given a lot of thought at what being an expert is, certainly in my two roles as a cardiac surgeon and an emergency surgeon and an airline pilot. I think that those are two operations that really require expertise, and I think it's a two-part question that demands a two-part answer. Part of it is, what exactly is expertise, and the subset of that is, how does one acquire it? And the second is, what defines an expert? I mean, lots of people have wrestled with these issues. Malcolm Gladwell has his 10,000 hour theory. I think you can find expertise in almost any human endeavor. It's not limited to high risk, high performers as you and I as pilots and physicians. They're expert baseball players who, one of the articles I wrote was a quote that when a batter is really truly focused in, the pitch, even coming 100 miles an hour, looks like a beach ball. So their expertise that can be gained in virtually anything humans endeavor to do. I love that Niels Bohr quote, but I think it's quite tongue-in-cheek. And when you refer to the kind of expertise that we're diving deeper into, it probably needs to be modified a bit. And I would say it's someone who's made every small mistake that you can make in one field, because expertise certainly defines good outcomes as a subset of the definition. The brilliance of this whole cockpit resource management, aviation safety, is that it starts with the assumption that humans will make mistakes and has engineered and designed a science to do really two critical things. I mean, one of which is to provide a curriculum of understanding how mistakes happen and how not to be the source of an irretrievably huge mistake that ends in a disaster. And that's certainly one of the primary definitions of an expert. It's an expert who commands a very deep and profound understanding of whatever his or her specialty might be. But the second part is that CRM has engineered an entire system into the vocabulary, and we call them SOPs, standard operating procedures of aviation safety, to provide a safety net that prevents the propagation of small human errors of going all the way through, as in Jim Reason's famous Swiss cheese model, all the way through the end to end up as tragic outcomes.
Well, I was just going to say that, in aviation, we talk about a great pilot knows when he's made his last or her last landing, and a not so great pilot doesn't know they've just made their last takeoff, right?
Certainly. And I mean, I think that's exactly true. I think some of the major issues surrounding true expertise has to do with exactly that. But one of the major differences that I think define an expert is someone who carries not only the knowledge and the skills not to make that first critical mistake, but also polices themselves with a system to understand when error is more likely to occur and to provide their own safety net that a small little misstep won't end up in a tragedy. And you have to understand, as part of being an expert, when bad things are likely to occur. As we both know, fatigue is one of the leading causes of error, and certainly emergency decisions, mass casualty stresses, they all contribute to all those holes in Jim Reason's old Swiss cheese thing. And so, I would probably define an expert in whatever his or her chosen field might be as someone who possesses and masters those two qualities. They have a deep and profound command and knowledge of their area of expertise, and they have the capability of supervising their own performance and operations to either not make the first big mistake, or if they do make little mistakes, to know how to catch them and prevent them from propagating into a disaster.
Yeah. I mean, this whole hubris thing, I was very lucky to be tutored as a pilot and as a surgeon by wonderfully humble people. And now when people say to me, if I've gone flying with them, how do you know when, you've made a really great landing? And my response is, when I've made one, I'll tell you. It's constantly having a sense that you can do better. So
absolutely. That's a critical, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's a critical point. I mean, a little hubris is okay. I mean, it's good to be proud of good outcomes.
Yeah, sure.
But I think the hubris also has to be directed at your fundamental capability and confidence in yourself that you'll catch a mistake if you make it. And the humility to understand that mistakes happen, but they don't have to be huge tragedy-inducing mistakes. They can be little things that you trip up and stumble and catch and correct before anything bad happens.
Absolutely. So let's change topic a little bit. Since 2015, you've been special liaison for trauma surgery and critical care, the Directorate General of Health, the Kurdish Regional Government, and Peshmerga Army in Iraq, in Erbil. Tell us about the conditions. What were the conditions when you got there, and how have they changed over time?
I've had three deployments to Kurdistan and Iraq, and I want to stress right from the outcome. I mean, I was not in uniform. I mean, it is associated with my affiliation on the faculty of the Army Trauma Training Center and training our FSTs, our forward surgical teams, and that's been truly an honor. But I wasn't kicking down doors and going after bad guys. I was there helping sewing up holes and advising the Iraqis and the Kurds on trauma system and trauma management. So the first time I went there was really in the heat of the battle with ISIS and how it affected the Kurds, particularly the Kurds and a subset of the Kurds, the Yazidis, were singled out and particularly traumatized by ISIS. And the whole politics of that is really beyond the discussion. But the system was well designed, mostly because of the incredible experience that the Iraqis and the Kurds had with dealing with mass injuries and mass casualties. We worked all over northern Iraq and Kurdistan. I mean, I was in medical facilities that were no much more than a little mattress on the floor in almost a cave, very close up to the border with the ISIS-controlled areas, all the way back to military hospitals and even private government hospitals, obviously in Erbil, in the capital of Kurdistan. The major problem is transportation there, and survivorship of war casualties is very time dependent. And you can look at military experience that UK and America had in all of our conflicts. And what we learned from those conflicts is, one, the value of helicopter transportation to get injured people quickly back to skilled operators. The other thing we learned is moving the facilities, which are forward surgical teams and as we call them, MASH units, mobile army surgical hospitals, as close to the battle as possible. And it's very time dependent. At the University of Miami, in our trauma center, we have an average of about 7 minutes transportation time, and our outcomes are phenomenal, well in the upper 90s for injuries that you would think should be fatal, but they're not. So what I tried to do with, especially with the Kurds, and the Peshmerga is just the Kurdish army. And we deployed with the Kurdish special operators and their medical units. And I mean, we trained their evacuation and their emergency surgeons in emergency airway management, cricothyroidotomy, chest injuries, a few miles of where the action was. I want to stress again, I never felt I was in harm's way. I mean, I was never closer than maybe 5 kilometers from anything serious. But what we learned is rapid emergency management. There was a very big push on with concerns for poisonous gas attacks and emergency management of airways under those circumstances. And I mean, you simply can't put an endotracheal tube in someone with an inflamed airway. Yeah, I mean, and one of the things we stressed was how to establish emergency early airway management. And those were the kind of lessons that that I was involved in teaching them. By the time my third deployment came about, I went to Mosul, which was the last holdout of ISIS. And ISIS was confined then to a few square kilometers, and we were in the emergency treatment facilities, Mosul Hospital, which was unfortunately blown up by a suicide bomber. It was just a few days before I got there, but in spite of all the war damage, the surgery went on, and the circumstances were austere, but the lessons were the same.
And I'm sure you've got some amazing stories, and I'm going to ask you to share one or two with us. And I believe that you operated on the commanding general of the Iraqi Northern Army Division, Major General Bakr, yes?
Yeah, General Bakr, yeah. I have to compliment the general. He was leading from the front, and why he, as a four-star general in the Iraqi army, he was leading his troops into Mosul, and he was a battle casualty. And I was asked, being the American surgeon, and for the aura that might bring with it. I mean, I'd like to think I was extremely well trained. I mean, at University of Miami, we were doing 300 and 400 thoracic trauma cases a year with the volume of trauma. So yeah, I operated on him in the middle of the night, and he fortunately did very well, so they stamped my visa to let me leave. But it was a similar lesson. I actually got into a bit of a discussion with one of the Iraqi surgeons, and one of my Peshmerga liaisons walked up very quietly and whispered in my ear, just offer your advice, you know, don't challenge the Iraqi surgeons, you're going to get them in trouble. So we discussed my thinking of how to manage the general, and that was how it was done. And fortunately, the outcome was good.
Oh, wow. Well, when you say you weren't in any danger, 5 kilometers away from people shooting at each other, I disagree with you. You were in danger, and you're a brave man, and you did some amazing things.
Well, thank you. That's kind of you to say, but I was the guy who they all tried to protect because they knew if they got hurt, I was there to help them. So I honestly was very well shielded.
Yeah, I always thought that if I got stopped by a police officer in the United States for speeding, that, you know, I had a police surgeon badge, and I always thought, you know, that would be a good one to pull. Never seemed to carry any weight though, Ken. So you've got another international affiliation, and you serve as a consultant in surgery and simulation at the Department of Surgery and my Spanish is awful, but it's the University of the Americas in Quito, in Ecuador.
Universidad de las Americas.
You see, there you are. You said that beautifully.
Yeah, well, that's the benefit of being in Miami. Without Spanish, you're lost. So my Spanish is fairly good.
So I tell people I'm bilingual. I speak English and American.
Ah, you must have heard a famous quote from your amazing, wonderful Winston Churchill.
I know exactly. Yes, go ahead. You state it.
Yeah, he commented that the United States and the United Kingdom were two wonderful nations separated only by a common language.
You've got it right. Absolutely. Lifts and elevators, trunks and boots. Yeah, absolutely. So tell us how you got involved with Quito and what you get up to there.
Sure. In my years in private practice, I lived and called San Diego my main base, my home. My kids are still there. One of the docs who I worked with is an Ecuadorian by birth and citizenship, and married an American aid worker, a nurse from San Diego. And they ended up moving back to San Diego. She wanted to go back to San Diego. So I worked very closely with this doc in San Diego. And they eventually went back, he and his wife, to Quito, which is, if you've never been there, is another one of the world's most beautiful places, and high up in the Andes with snow-capped volcanoes that are active and stunning. So he rose through the ranks and became the dean of the medical school in Quito, the Universidad de las Americas, and invited me to participate in their faculty. So I've made probably well over a dozen trips to Ecuador and Guayaquil and Quito, and been involved in their surgical curriculum development and teaching their residents, and been able to see some of the more austere ways that medicine has to be practiced in the rural parts of Ecuador, and had some involvement with the Ecuadorian army towards the north end, where they're still in a war with the FARC terrorists from Colombia, mostly drug transportation. And it's been very rewarding. I love seeing how other nations and cultures practice, especially surgery. I've been 3 times in China, and rural Western China, and obviously in Northwest Asia and Iraq and Kurdistan and all over South America. And it's just fascinating to see the cultural differences in medicine. Been very rewarding.
Yeah, I always thought that, but like you, I've been privileged to travel a fair bit, China and South America and such like, never been to Ecuador. And it's a huge privilege teaching other people, and the friendships you make become friendships for life. So
absolutely.
Yeah, amazing. So you've written a fair amount about patient safety and error reduction strategies. And I'm sure a lot of that comes from your experience with airplanes. What would you say, and we've touched on it earlier, but if you had to distill out some key strategies for how doctors can avoid making errors?
Yes, that's been a passion of mine. I live it, breathe it, teach it to my residents and medical students, and have tried to practice in private practice and all my surgical endeavors. And I think it comes back, just as you've said a moment ago, to the earlier discussion about expertise. And there, I would say the two main lessons that partially learned in aviation and certainly partially learned in medicine, but adapted across both of those endeavors of mine, is I would say that it's a deep down understanding of how mistakes can happen, and a humility, as I mentioned a moment ago, that you can make a mistake, and making the mistake isn't the problem. The problem is missing the mistake. And whether that's in a cockpit of an airplane or in an operating room, little things can happen. And part of the patient safety, of the surgical safety lessons from aviation, is it's important to keep very much in the forefront of your mind when mistakes are most likely to happen. And you and I both know all the literature and data on, well, for example, fatigue. I mean, when did the Exxon Valdez strike a sandbar and break apart with the biggest oil spill? Was the middle of the night. When did Chernobyl melt down? The middle of the night. When did Bhopal, that horrible chemical spill in India? All of these things happen in the middle of the night, and they happen in the middle of the night because people are tired, and tired brains do not process information as accurately, and I think importantly, nor do they catch these tiny little missteps that are more prone to happen. But there are other times. There's really good data. A very good paper I've referred to in some of my AOPA articles on error-producing conditions, and it's a real science. It comes actually from your nation, from the UK, and it was a whole body of literature that was paid for and developed by the nuclear power industry. But fatigue, you know, urgent decision making under urgent conditions, stress, lack of communication, those are all times when errors are more likely to occur. And one of the huge lessons I've taken from the cockpit to the operating room is a real profound, I would like to believe, maybe I'm being a little too self-aggrandizing, but a real deep understanding of when I'm most likely to make a mistake. And those are the times that an expert, as we commented before, and the cockpit lessons are, that's the time for just super vigilance. And communication is critical also. I mean, I've walked into the operating room in the middle of the night and said to everyone, from the medical student observing to whoever's working with me on the case, look, it's late. I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to miss something. You're going to miss something, but we're not going to miss the same thing. And we're going to keep each other under surveillance. And the lines of communication are open. If I do something, tell me. If you do something, I'll tell you, and we'll catch it before it becomes a huge problem. And, you know, they call it crew resource management in the airplane. I teach my residents lessons on clinical resource management. It's CRM. I just change the first letter. In my capacity with the Air Force Auxiliary, I'm an officer and a captain. I teach a course to the Czech airmen and our CFIs, our flight instructors, on single pilot safety. And the whole body of that information is that you have to provide for yourself all the safety nets that a crew would normally do in a large commercial carrier or in an operating room, which is the second part of expertise that we've covered a few minutes ago, is that, you know, the capability of being your own safety net, of catching those little missteps yourself before they propagate through all Jim Reason's layers of cheese we've also covered into a real tragedy.
Yeah. Well, talking of tragedy, there was a recent tragedy on a Western movie film set where actor Alec Baldwin unwittingly fired a live round from a handgun that killed one crew member and injured another. I lived in America Well, for half my life, I know guns are a deeply political issue in the United States, irrevocably tied to concepts of personal freedom. But they also represent a health crisis. I don't want to get into the politics, but I used to wear a little badge one of my colleagues gave me, which was sort of like the red circle with a diagonal line, no to guns. How can physicians contribute to a debate and diminish firearm violence that robs about, what is it, 30,000 lives a year in America? It's the worst in the world.
Yeah, it's gun deaths are, as you've alluded to, and something we probably should spend not more than a second or two on, is about the 25th or something leading cause of death in the CDC. It's about 30,000, but those statistics are, again, once they get into the political and the press range, are skewed.
Yes.
About 18,000 of those deaths are suicides. And, you know, whether you can argue whether a gun ought to be available for someone to kill themselves, but the flip side of that is someone wants to kill themselves, there are any number of ways of doing it. So there are probably about 12,000 homicide deaths in the United States a year in a country of 370 million people. So it sounds like a huge number. It can be parsed into more meaningful numbers. But I absolutely agree with you. I mean, it's, you know, gun ownership was really the founding principle of our nation. And I think if you weren't raised with it, you know, maybe, I don't know what analogy would be. I mean, it's very much part of the American psyche and American culture. I mean, it's, you look at us and say, how can we allow guns? And, you know, we look at you across the pond there and said, how can you drink warm, bitter beer? I mean, you
careful, you know, careful, Ken. But no, I take your point. I take your point.
This was a tragedy. I mean, it's a tragedy of almost in incomprehensible magnitude for the family of this poor woman. I think she had a young daughter. I mean, there's a family who lost an irreplaceable treasure, a daughter, a mom, a sister. And, you know, regardless of what you think about Alec Baldwin politically and his stance, it's a tragedy for him too. I mean, he's going to have a flashback of standing in front of somebody and pulling a trigger and killing him and having their blood splashed on him, and probably will haunt him every night too. So it's an all-around tragedy. But, you know, there's always a lesson to be learned from the best and the worst things. And I mean, I think this reflects someone who was doing a hugely dangerous thing, handling a gun, really without any expertise, without any experience, without any training, without any true understanding of the consequences. I mean, I've commented several times on when bad things might happen. Bad things happen when you point a gun at somebody. I mean, and that's, I mean, there's a whole curriculum. I mean, we have our NRA, the National Rifle Association. I mean, it is so well known in the culture that safe gun handling, really, you know, that's the argument. I mean, you can't deny responsible U.S. citizens. I mean, we have it, the Second Amendment of the Constitution is the right to bear arms, but it's not any old right to bear arms. It's only the right to bear arms safely. You know, I think that these people, all of them on the set, they violated every rule of gun safety there is. And that's exactly when tragedies happen. I mean, this never would have happened if they had the slightest bit of training and expertise in handling guns.
Especially at a time when you can deal with this with CGI, with computer-generated interface. And in fact, I have handled guns, I have had guns, I've gone through firearm training, and there's two very good aphorisms, aren't there? When is a gun loaded? A gun is always loaded. And when do you point a gun at someone? When you want to kill them.
Absolutely. Never point a gun at someone, something you don't intend to destroy.
You got it. So my final question, Florida's got some lovely beaches, and I believe you're out on an island. So imagine you're going for a stroll one evening along one of the beautiful beaches there. You find a bottle, you pick it up, you rub it, out pops a genie who grants you three wishes to improve human health. What would Professor Stahl's wishes be?
Well, what a question. Well, I think that One of the jobs physicians have isn't to make it so people live forever. I mean, nobody lives forever. But what we do is we eliminate suffering. And I mean, now that I actually volunteer, I mean, I volunteer for the service. I mean, they still pay me for it, but I work in the COVID ICU, you know, about a week or 10 days a month. And one of the things I always stress with the families of those patients is this is a horrible illness. Your relative, your dad, your mom, your brother, your sister may die of it, but what they're not going to do is suffer. Physicians, in the end, we temporize illness. We don't cure it. So one of the wishes I would make is to eliminate suffering, because you're going to die, I'm going to die, everybody's going to die, but we don't have to suffer to do it. And you and I have both seen people who have had really, really traumatic, horrible exits. And I would say that the first thing I would wish for is that even though people will eventually die, they do it without suffering. So that's one wish. That would be, I think, a wonderful thing if people kept that in mind. I think religion, maybe some people's religions maybe give them that support, but certainly pain is a big deal and we're here to take it away from people. I mean, another thing I think wish for is the insight and the intelligence into the miraculous human body. I mean, being surgeons, we know what's beneath the skin. And, you know, just like I have a moment of awe at the end of the runway when I hear clear to take off and I fire all the throttles and start rolling and lift into the air. I mean, I remember the first time I was handed a scalpel and allowed to make an incision as a medical student, and I was awestruck. And I would say that another thing I would wish for is the intelligence to understand a little bit more of how miraculous our own bodies are. I mean, whether it's immunity to fight disease or the surveillance that we have to kill abnormal cells that might become cancers. And I think with an understanding of that miraculous function of our anatomy and physiology, we could help it. Now, like I said, we're not going to ever make people live forever, but we may be able to come up with better ways to help our own system survive illness. And third of all, I'd wish for everybody just happiness of their lives, you know, just, you know, joy and happiness in their lives and just enjoy every day, because every day is a miracle and every day is something that goes in the books and can never be relived. And, you know, I used to joke with people that I never try to get too excited, because I think at birth you're granted a certain number of heartbeats, and the more excited you are, the faster you use up your heartbeat.
Yeah, that's like the old jokes, isn't it, about what's all this big deal about exercise? I've only got a given number of heartbeats. Why don't I?
Yeah, it's like my wonderful father-in-law likes to say, he'd never give up smoking. It's good exercise for his lungs. But I think that I would just wish that everybody just cherishes every moment of their lives. And it's precious, it's miraculous, and once you've lived it, it's not going to be relived.
You got that right. And in fact, the World Health Organization considers health to not just be the absence of disease, right? Or the United Nations. I forget whose quote that is, but it's a great one. Listen, Ken, thanks so much for joining us today and sharing your wisdom on so many topics.
Let me leave you with one other quote.
Yeah, sure.
When I was at the Cleveland Clinic, one of the founders of their heart surgery program, which, as you know, is world-renowned, Rene Favalero, and he died, and one of the eulogies given said that Rene Favalero was a physician who never lost sight of the fact that our patients are souls whose bodies are broken. And I was always touched by that and always tried to approach my patients with that kind of an attitude.
Well, that's a beautiful perspective, Ken. Really, really appreciate all your wisdom. Proud to call you friend and colleague. Hope you don't slow down all your wonderful activities. Keep at it. And I also hope that we can go flying together sometime.
Please, yeah.
I've always learned, whoever I've gone flying with, I've learned something new, and I bet I would learn a hell of a lot from you.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. And I would enjoy that with you also.
That would be a hoot. Well, listen, folks, that's it for now. Please join us next week for another episode of the EMG Health Podcast. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and stay curious. Bye for now.